The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 116.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's a really good buddy of mine from down under. His name is Martin North, and he's with DFA Analysts. Martin, welcome back to the Rebel Capitalist Show, my friend.
Hello, George. How are you going?
Doing very, very well here in St. Bart's. Now, I want to dive right into the data because this is really what you do. It's your specialty, and you've got your finger on the pulse of what's going on, especially with the housing market in Australia. So let's dive into the data because I think last time we talked, there has been some dramatic changes, and then try to take that and maybe layer it over Canada, maybe other markets that might be a little frothy, to see what we can take away for that might benefit the viewer.
55%, right? And that's because of COVID and because people aren't working. Right. And what that really is saying is that we are now in a very precarious position where prices are already beginning to slide. We're seeing it in most centers. The high-level indices are sort of talking about, you know, a few percent, you know, 3% or so in Melbourne in the last quarter. So prices went up and then they went along and now they're down. But that doesn't tell you anything, right? Because what you need to do is to get really, really granular. And look, I lost my rag last week, right? I actually made a show called Housing from Soup to Nuts, right, which is on my channel. And I went through in painful detail from the macro picture, which is too much debt, household confidence decaying, the mortgage sector supported by, banks don't have to report loans where there've been no repayments, where there's a repayment holiday as in any way in default, right? So those loans are just okay. And they've been doing that for 6 months and they just extend that for another 4 months. What they did say was that if you are a borrower with essentially a repayment holiday, the bank should be talking to you about whether your income's likely to come back or not, right? Because if it's not, sometime you got to change it, right?
Right.
The RBA, our central bank here, has been making cheap funds available to the banks, 60 basis points down from where they were previously. So effectively, those flows of funds go back into the banks, and the regulator said, no, that's fine, you can now start paying dividends again. There's a flow of money, right, from the central bank to support the banks, cheap funds, so that shareholders can receive dividends. So that sort of cycle's going. And then you've got this broader canvas where you've got more and more households who are struggling with their mortgages. Now, I do a lot of detailed analysis looking at cash flow, money in, money out, and I can now tell you that mortgage stress in Australia has now reached an astonishing 40.2% of households. That's the highest it's ever been, right?
And
that's the latest data.
Stress, Martin?
Cash flow, money in, money out. So let's look at how much money is coming in each month. Let's look at how much money is going out each month. And, you know, basically what I argue is if there's more money going out than coming in, you have
stress.
A problem. I mean, it's pretty simple, right? They might have, you know, investment properties, they might have stocks and shares, they might have, credit cards they can. But effectively, if you have a cash flow deficit that's continuing, then you ultimately have a problem.
Right. 40%.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of other people say, no, you don't have to look at it like that. You know, it's fine. But no, you have to. You have to look at holistically. You have to look at all the cash flows, right? Then you look at rental stress. So these are people in the rental sector, right? Paying those rents mostly to property investors, right? And in fact, we've got a similar proportion, just under 40%, of renters who are in stress. Right. In other words, they have not got the income now to pay their rents. And then this is new analysis. I've also looked at property investors themselves. Right. And property investors, which are, of course, relying on income from the investment properties, from the renters who are not now paying their rents, relying on, capital gain. Well, there's no capital gain there at the moment. So we've actually got now about a quarter of property investors who are now very much on the edge and in fact looking to sell. So wherever you look in the property market, right, it's like a, you know, a lump of jelly. It's going all over the place, right? But what the critical thing is, cash flow is now crunching. And as a result of that, we're starting to see significant price movements. And in my soup to nuts thing, I actually went down a level and said, now let's look at individual properties. And I took about 40 or 50 property examples from around the country. And I showed that if you look at real data down at the property level, right, and you look at the last transaction that was made maybe, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 years ago, and now, in every case, the asking price is now lower than the transaction. So the high-level indices are completely blurring what's really going on. So we're now in the situation where we've got this massive issue with flows of people on government support trying to wrestle with these massive big mortgages at a time when property prices are on the slide. And the final point, and then I'll let you speak. I'm just so wound up about this. The final point is the number of people now who are saying, I'm going to have to sell in the next 6 or 12 months, right, has gone through the roof. So it's gone up significantly. Property investors now, but now I'm starting to see owner occupiers now saying, time to get out because there's no capital growth. This is going to be a crunch. And postscript, unemployment by the end of this year is going to be at around 9.25% according to the latest Treasury forecast. And that's probably optimistic.
All right. And do you guys measure unemployment there like we do it here with the U3 and the U6 number?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty similar. It's not quite the same, but basically the official number is well understated because effectively you have to be looking for a job, and you know, even an hour takes you out of the core numbers, right? The real number is probably closer to 12 to 15%, depending on how you're calculating. If you include underemployment as well, in other words, those who would like more hours, then you're close to 20% of the population now. Now, I should also add, we've just had Melbourne move into basically stasis for 6 weeks, which is a quarter of the economy because of COVID. So they've completely locked down Melbourne. Most businesses are being shut again. So we're not pulling out of COVID down there in Victoria. We are effectively now going into a lockdown mode, and all of the states now have got barriers up so you can't cross between states. So we've got lockdown city here.
I mean, that is just, talk about Orwellian.
I know. Mean,
just, or maybe not Orwellian, but authoritarian. It's like a police state type thing. But let's go back to Melbourne for a moment, because I think that would be directly applicable to a lot of the viewers from the United States, because so many of the states, such as Texas, Florida, and I haven't been there, but from what I'm hearing on Twitter and whatnot, and some from family and friends, they went to this lockdown, or maybe a semi type of lockdown. Then they opened things back up, and then they saw the case count rise. I believe that the death rate has risen a lot slower, thank goodness, and maybe even declined. But because of whatever reason, you know, whether they're just looking at the case count and getting freaked out about it, or maybe there's media, who knows why, but then they're going into a further lockdown mode again. So they go from kind of like semi-lockdown to kind of semi-opened up to now more draconian type of lockdown. So since you're so close with the numbers in Australia, I'd be curious to know how that's affected Melbourne specifically, because they've kind of, it looks like they're going through this cycle as we speak.
Yeah, well, I think the problem in Melbourne has been that they got very close to the elimination of the virus in the state. And in fact, I think we were quite close across the whole of Australia, really. Then, unfortunately, they had some shenanigans with regard to the hotel accommodation. So that when people came in from overseas, they had to go into forced hotel accommodation for 2 weeks. And it now transpires that the training for the people who were running those hotels basically was awful, and people just basically didn't take it seriously. People were allowed to go out. So that really allowed the virus to come back into the community, and then it spread. It started to spread then amongst the lower socioeconomic groups, the people in particularly insecure work. One of the themes that's really come out to here, George, is that we've got more and more people who are not on permanent work agreements. So in other words, if you don't work, if you don't turn up for a shift, you don't get paid. And that really has put a really significant spotlight now on a lot of the people who effectively were identified as carriers of the virus potentially, or they may not having symptoms, were told to go home and isolate, but most of them didn't. And about one third didn't. They just went on and went back to work. So there's a fundamental socio-economic problem here with the fact that we've got so many people in insecure work. We've got also a cultural issue that people don't like being told what to do. You know, I understand that, right? And as you say, we've got more and more draconian measures. So effectively, a state of disaster was declared in Melbourne yesterday, right? Which basically gives the police huge powers to, you know, lock people down, close down events. I mean, this is pretty remarkable stuff. And yeah, the numbers are rising, and that, you know, worryingly, and everyone's are saying, well, if we hadn't done what we'd done, it would have been even more astronomical. But, you know, on a relative basis, it's still relatively small, and the death count is still mercifully quite small, mostly older people, although not exclusively. Yeah. And the economic impact, of course, is absolutely astonishing, because we hadn't recovered from the first time. The bounce back, the V-shape that everyone was talking about, well, I think we discussed a couple of shows ago, well, it wasn't going to be V-shaped, it was going to be W at best and probably, you know, sawtooth. What we're seeing is essentially that economic impact continuing. They tried to allow the economy to come back with some social distancing, with some rules and regs, and really that didn't work. Then they've tightened, and now they've actually basically said, right, for 6 weeks, it's complete lockdown, other than supermarkets and, you know, pharmacies and a couple of other categories of retail. Everyone else is locked down now, so you can't basically, you know, shop. You've got to stay in your houses and all those things, and then you've got the you know, the police force basically keeping an eye on it. Now, the point, of course, here is that this is going to have a huge impact, not just in Victoria, but because of the fact that Victoria has a number of significant ports. You know, trade coming into the country is going to be impacted, trade out of the country is going to be impacted. So this is going to spill over. And we've got more cases now in other states too. So the worry is that we might have actually already let the cat out of the bag in terms of actually more virus, presence in other locations in the community. And this time it's in the community, whereas last time around it was actually people from overseas coming into Australia. But boy, the economic impact and the social impact is just remarkable.
You know what this highlights, Martin, is people get very opinionated on the virus and what should be done and what shouldn't be done. But regardless of where you fall on that spectrum, we'll call it, this really highlights the importance of whatever you're considering, always doing a cost-benefit analysis, right? It goes back to my favorite economist, Thomas Sowell, always says there are no solutions. There are only alternatives. And that's because we're dealing with scarce resources with alternative uses. And regardless of how you see, whether it's COVID or it's anything in macroeconomics, people tend to look at just the benefits, and then the costs are just so insignificant, I'm not even going to look at them. Or they get hyper-focused on just the costs, and they don't even consider the benefits. And it's just an incomplete analysis that leads us, as a society, I think, to making very emotional decisions, especially when you're dealing with something of this magnitude. We really need to have our thinking caps on, to say the least, and not get too hyper-emotional about it. You know, go ahead. Do you have something to say there?
And I just wanted to say, you're absolutely right. And remember, we've got to be thinking about this as a 2 to 3 year thing, right? You can't hang all your hopes on magically a virus being eliminated by some sort of vaccine, you know, in an immediate time frame. It might happen. That would be great. But you can't assume that is going to be there. So we have to find a way of living with this thing and trading off. And as you say, making sure that the economy isn't completely, killed in the process. And there's a massive swing going on here in Australia between those who say, no, we've got to actually, allow some deaths to happen because effectively that's the price of keeping the economy open on one side, through to, no, absolutely every death is not acceptable. Right. and therefore we've got to just sacrifice the economy. And I don't see how you can, you know, oscillate between those two. That's what's been happening over the last. So if I go back 3 or 4 months at both federal and state level, it was very much about, you know, lockdown, deaths must be resisted. Then they sort of put the pendulum back the other way and said, no, we need the economy back, please. Because, of course, the economic impact of locking everything down was astonishing. And yeah. So we've sort of gone backwards and forwards. Now, of course, what we should have done is to have actually pushed that closure just slightly harder and got to elimination. I think if we'd done that, and if we had watertight processes at the borders and in those hotel scenarios, bit like New Zealand, we could have had a scenario where the economy would have been able to actually come back, you know, more readily. But we're now in this sort of oscillatory environment, and you've actually got people right there across the spectrum because they're making different trade-offs, just as you're saying, you know, because there is no single solution here, right? What is the right trade-off? How many deaths are acceptable? How many aren't acceptable? We've got 10% of cases in Melbourne in the medical community, right? So the people who are treating those with COVID, 10% of the cases are now actually from that source. So you've got this question of, well, if you're not careful, you end up with the health system collapsing again, right? I mean, these are horribly tricky dilemmas. And I just think that we've got this sort of high-level narrative. There's very little good analysis and there's very little good discussion to try and get to a better point of saying, how do we live with this for 2 or 3 years? Because I think that's what we should be asking ourselves.
Yeah, see, I take a little bit different approach because, or what I think would be ideal. Obviously, there's no ideal here. It's just, it's kind of the best of the worst scenarios.
The least worst.
The least worst, yeah, exactly. But when I, you know, obviously, if we were all just kind of this is like a board game that we were playing. You just go ahead and lock everything down, and you try to eliminate it worldwide, and then you just move on. My concern with that is that it sets a precedence moving forward for a bigger and bigger police state, and less personal freedom. I go back to the Patriot Act that we had here in 2001 after 9/11. Yep. And, you know, I mean, I remember back in the day, you know, I was a little kid in the 1970s and flying, and this I'm sure dates me quite a bit, but I remember when they used to allow people to smoke on the plane. I don't know if you remember that.
I remember that too. Yeah.
Yeah. When they had like the smoking seats and stuff. Yeah. But back then there was no TSA. There was no, I mean, getting on a plane was basically the same type of experience as getting on a bus. It's just, there's your bags, you go over there, you get on the plane. It's just, what we have today is so extreme based on, when you compare it to prior 2011, or even, you know, in the 70s and 80s, which I was describing. And I see it, you know, once the camel's nose is under the tent, it's really, I think they take more and more and more opportunity to seize control and micromanage our everyday lives. So I understand the human component. I understand the economic component. But what I try to think through as well is the personal freedom component of it. And if we allow government to cross that line, it's just they just take bigger and bigger steps towards this police state that I'm extremely concerned about, to say the least. And so I think that ideally, you know, when you mix all those things together, I wish the government here in the States or wherever would have said, listen, here are the facts as we know them, and they're always changing. Here's the best data that we have at our disposal right now. Here's what our recommendations are. Our recommendations are X, Y, and Z. Now, you guys, go ahead and make your own decisions. If you feel as though it's the smart thing to do to shut your business because of liability or ethics, morals, whatever, you go ahead and do that. If you want to stay home because you're in a high risk group, go ahead and do that. Hopefully, like in Colombia, there's so many services that popped up where you didn't even have to leave your apartment. They just deliver it to you. I mean, it's like an instant Amazon type economy in like 2 weeks. It just sprung up, right? And so I think, and again, you know, hindsight's 2020. You can't say, well, this would have been better, because there's no counterfactual, I guess. But I just, from a personal freedom standpoint and liberty, I wish we could have seen something like that, maybe more like a Sweden, but we'll have to see how it plays out. And there's so many unknowns, and we're still trying to figure out what this thing is and what it's capable of.
Yeah, well, you know, it's an experiment in, you know, real life, isn't it? And yeah, right. Nobody knows, right? But I agree. And look, your point about personal freedom, I think, let's just look at it from a terrorism perspective, right? So if you think of what's happened over the last 20 years, certainly here in Australia, and I suspect other countries, the amount of hoops you have to go through to travel, and the amount of focus and the amount of control that governments now have, all on the keeping the country safe, keeping you safe, right? I think it's out of order relative to the impact that might have been had if they'd actually not gone down that route. It's been used as an excuse, right? It's been used as a pretext, and basically we'll be strong on law and government, we'll be strong on law and order, we'll protect you. And in fact, our civil liberties, even here in Australia, have been eroded, controlled, the media is more controlled. You know, now, ask how many people in Australia got killed last year from terrorism. It's a very, very low number. And in fact, where there were mostly lone actors, right? Mm-hmm. So let me give you a comparative number. Okay. Last year in Australia, around 4,000 people died from asbestos-related disease, right? Which is way higher than car accidents, way higher than other things. Nobody even talks about that, right? Somehow we've got a myopic focus from government on control and, you know, giving up civil liberties for one particular set of agendas from people who want to keep more control. And I think government likes to have control and wants more control. They always, and I remind people that it took several hundred years to gain civil liberties and, you know, to be frank, to create a level of freedom that we had in the 60s, 70s, and maybe in the 80s, which I think was pretty remarkable. But we've given it up. Yeah. And the more we give it up, and I think COVID is just another example, we're giving up more freedom. We're basically being herded into a narrow and narrower space, and overlay the digital control and digitalization and everything else as well. The future looks really bleak. And, yeah, and somehow governments seem to, you know, just say, well, that's the way it's got to be. And we're thinking, well, who asked? Nobody's asked us, right? Okay. Surely there should be a different conversation here, because freedom and personal responsibility and personal accountability go together. If you actually end up being dependent and essentially just simply saying, well, you know, I've been told to do X, so I'll do X, that's a child-parent relationship rather than a parent or an adult relationship, right? Why can't the state have an adult relationship with us rather than actually saying, thou shalt?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it too. And then you think about all the money that was spent on these additional quote unquote security measures like TSA, yep, in the United States. Yep. And then the counter argument to that as well, if we didn't have TSA, if we didn't have these organizations, then we would have had all of these, we would have had a lot more terrorist attacks. But my counter argument to that is something that's very anecdotal, it's a personal story, but I think it really sends the message. And I don't know if I've told you this story, but I'll tell it quickly here because I think it hits the nail on the head about, I don't know when it was, maybe 2012, something like that. I was dating a gal in New York, and we went to this flea market in Brooklyn there, and I bought this necklace at this flea market that has this rifle shell on it, Martin. I mean, it's the size of your index finger. I mean, it's giant. It's huge. And it's not like an emptied rifle shell either. It's like, well, it probably is, but, you know, it's got the head on it or whatever it's called. And so this is this necklace. And I didn't even think about it. I threw it in my toiletries bag for traveling because I flew to New York to see the gal. And about, I mean, maybe 2 years went by, and I travel a lot. I took probably within that 2 year time, I mean, 50 flights at least, at a very minimum, flying all over the United States, all over the world. And I totally forgot that I had that rifle shell necklace in my toiletries bag. And I went through countless TSAs where they took my water bottle, they took my cuticle scissors, They took my tweezers. They took all of these things. And out of the 50 or 100 times I went through TSA, you know how many of them found that rifle shell? Zero.
Yes.
Zero.
Yep. Yep.
So if you think a terrorist that is just even reasonably smart can't get through TSA if they want to, you are absolutely kidding yourself. The only people that the TSA is preventing on getting on flights or whatever are people who are law-abiding citizens.
Let me get on mine just briefly. I worked in London during the 80s and 90s, right, when the IRA was blowing up the place. And you know, I was actually in London when the bombs went off, particularly a couple of the big ones. So I know what damage terrorism can do, right? And I've seen the carnage and I've seen the physical damage and I've walked down bomb streets, even in the center of London. So let's not, you know, I'm not trying to belittle all of that. That was horrible. And, you know, they needed to do things. But imposing the level of restraint that we've now got on everybody, you know, wherever you are, simply because of, you know, some terrorism in some places is just overreach. And I come back to this fundamental point that, which is what I think you've said too, you know, that people will find a way if they're gonna do something. But surely if you've got a more open society where you've actually got more freedom and therefore more responsibility, there's less likely to be people wanting to do bad things.
Yeah.
So you can actually sort of turn the argument the other way and say, well, let's try and make an open democracy, you know, where in fact there are ways where people can express their opinions and concerns and those things. And then they don't have to resort to sort of the violence and those sorts of things that people are so worried about. But if you just count up the, you know, the real impact of this in terms of the financial impact, the costs to people in terms of time. I mean, going to an airport now is like, you know, well, I hate it. we've given up something. And I come back to the fact that those in government seem to enjoy exerting that extra power. They seem to enjoy, you know, imposing their will on the people that they've, you know, been elected by. I just think there's something very rotten at the core of this. And it goes back to what the core value set is that's driving the decisions they make.
This podcast is brought to you by Rebel Capitalist Pro, the best online investing research. I have teamed up with Chris McIntosh and Lynn Alden, two of the best in the business, to create Rebel Capitalist Pro and give you the tools you need to build wealth and thrive in this crazy world of economic insanity. Rebel Capitalist Pro is jam-packed with Chris and Lynn's incredible research. We have live stream Q&As where you can ask your questions directly to Chris, Lynn, and myself. And the best of all, there's an online member forum which allows you to network, learn, and explore ideas with like-minded individuals. What are you waiting for? Check out Rebel Capitalist Pro right now at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. Take action today and do something your future self will thank you for.
Yeah, but see, I think that government attracts that type of personality.
Okay, yeah, that's probably right.
Because if you think about what it takes to be a politician, yeah. I mean, why would you do that? Like you have to lie. You have to have just zero moral compass. You have to have no ethics. You have to be able to just say not what you believe, yeah, but whatever you think will get you the most votes. Think about what type of mentality, what type of personality is required. And then think about the type of personality or individual that says, oh, I want to do that. Oh, that sounds fantastic. Oh, sign me up. You know, like who does that? And the bigger government gets, the more power that they wield over the everyday person, the more ethically challenged, let's say, I think the people that want to fill those political roles are. And it just, you know, I've had a lot of experience with politicians that I don't really talk about a lot, you know, going back to 2009. And that's what really, you know, before 2009 in my interactions with quite a few politicians where I actually got to experience, you know, how they really are, not how they seem on TV. You know, I just thought that they were good natured, you know, kind of public servants, like they were there to try to, you know, do good. And that all those crazy things that you hear about, that, well, that's just China, that's just Russia, that doesn't happen here in the United States. And then I saw it firsthand, and I saw what happened, you know, with my interactions with these people. I said, holy, I mean, my eyes were opened, and I just thought, man, these people are the bottom of the barrel.
Well, I tend to agree. I have quite a lot to do with politicians here. And two observations. The first is the opposition and the people in power are all wired the same way. There's minor differences at the edge, but actually they're all on the same side, right? So I don't see it like, you know, the people in power versus the good guys, right? They're both on the same side. And in fact, it's the politicians, and I'll put the central bank and the other regulators all on the same side, right? Against you and me, right? That's the way that society is actually wired at the moment, right? First point. Second point is there are some good individuals within politics who actually are conviction politicians and believe real things. But when you talk to them about how the political machine works, they are unable to make any effective change.
Right.
Because as soon as they try, they get chucked out of the machine or they get put on the back bench and have no influence. The people in power are part of the machine, quite often career politicians or people who've you know, come into politics later but have played the game. And they're playing a game. And the game is re-election, 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 right? The game is not benefiting the broader community and essentially making the world a better place. Because if it was, they'd be doing different things.
Yeah,
it's about power, it's about authority, and it's about self-preservation and self-protection. And I think that's the real issue that we face. And, you know, in a way, I think COVID has been a bit of a spotlight to show what's really going on in the underbelly of politics here, right? Because it's playing to script, right? They're doing precisely what you'd expect them to do. But all of this is about preserving their own face, making them look strong, making them look as though, you know, we're going to be reelected next time around. I give up. And I don't give up. That would be wrong. That's one of the reasons why I do DFA. There's a really important alternative voice here about what needs to be done and the way that we need to think differently about our politics and our society. Because I believe that ultimately most people are actually, you know, on the ground, real people are good. They've got well-intended and they, you know, they want to do the right thing and they want to succeed. And yet we don't seem to be enabling that. And I remember I said the other time, turn the pyramid upside down and enable. I mean, that for me is becoming more and more critical in terms of the way I think about it, right? We need to have a set of governing principles that enables people to be successful and enables people to do the things they want to do, rather than imposing top-down a set of ideologies or a set of rules or a set of commandments. Because otherwise, basically, you might as well say, well, give me the rules, stone tablets, we'll just follow. And turn my brain off, I'll just follow the rules. That is not the society I want to be part of.
Exactly. And I think you said it so perfectly. You got to treat people like they're an adult. If you treat them like a kid, then that's not what we're looking for here. So I want to that was a great topic. I really enjoyed the conversation, but I want to move on to get your opinion on a couple things, kind of dovetailing on that conversation. I want to hear how you would set up the banking system and compared to the way we have it now that would facilitate the spirit of the individual and the small and mid-sized business. So if you could kind of outline how the banking system works in Australia, I assume it's similar in the United States. I'll maybe chime in there. And then how we could make some changes there that would go from benefiting just a small group of corporations who are politically connected to benefiting the local entrepreneur that's the real growth engine of job creation.
Yeah. Well, I think there are three or four principles, George. The first is, if you look at the way that banks make their money at the moment, they make most of their money from trading and from derivative speculation. Right. Than they do relative to, you know, the real stuff they should be doing, which is lending to businesses. So remember, there's a thing called Glass-Steagall, which basically created the gap between, you know, trading for their own right, you know, and core banking. That was, of course, abolished some years ago in the US, and it's been the same in many other places too. That was a major mistake. And in fact, I would argue that the global financial crisis in 2008 was triggered predominantly by the fact that earlier they got rid of Glass-Steagall. Clinton, I think, got rid of it last time, right?
Yeah.
So the first thing I would do is to say banking is about banking. It's not about speculation and derivative trading. Now, you can create those entities separately, but they should not be connected to core banking. The reason is that particularly when interest rates are really low.
We got hedge funds.
When interest rates are really low, right, banks make more money from speculative trading and trading on their own book than they do from core lending and core deposits, right? And that means that they don't focus on the right things. And by the way, it also increases huge risk into core banking, right? So that's the first thing I'd look at. The second thing is, if you talk to SMEs, I survey SMEs all the time here, you know, real businesses, right? They cannot get the funding that they need to drive the innovation and creativity that they have to be able to take their business forward. They just cannot do it here in Australia. Right.
What response do they typically get from the bank? Like if they go to a loan, the bank just says, sorry.
Either they say no, you're too risky, or they say, put your house on the line, even for a relatively small loan.
Okay.
So it really is. And you know, a lot of the businesses that I talk with have ended up going to some of the neo lenders. So, you know, some of the new fintechs, but they charge very high interest rates.
Sure.
So the whole economic engine here of creating entrepreneurial activity amongst the small business sector, we've got 3 million small businesses here in Australia, more than half of them cannot get the funding they need to be able to do the things they want. So we have to find a way of breaking that nexus. Now, the reason is that because the banks much prefer to lend for mortgage lending, as we've discussed previously, right? Because the risk ratios for mortgage lending relative to the lending to SMEs is completely different. So it's about a quarter risky in terms of the capital you have to put for mortgages relative to business lending, right? Now that's because of the Basel rules, right? Those were actually cooked up by those propeller heads up in Switzerland, right? And is now imposed top down across all banks around the world to protect the banking system, right? But what it's doing is it's actually directing activity away from real productive areas to mortgage growth.
And are you're talking about Basel III, Martin?
Yeah.
Okay, can you unpack that a little bit? I don't know how much research you've done there, but if you've done a little bit, can you unpack Basel III for the average viewer and then kind of tell us how that is affecting the banks just exclusively going into mortgages and just ignoring the SMEs?
Yeah, okay. So the way you have to think about it is that there is a thing called a risk-weighted asset. So when you actually calculate the amount of capital that you have to hold on your balance sheet, right, and there's a set of rules about that, right? But what you do is you take your total, let's say, total mortgage pool, $1 million, right? Mm-hmm. But then you risk-weight it. And that risk, those risk weights are determined by Basel and then translated into locally. So in fact, you don't need to hold capital for the total of your mortgages. On average, it's around 25% of your mortgages. So basically, you write it down before you actually apply capital. So what it means is that if you're a bank and you have to hold the capital and capital costs, you know, you either have to raise the funds or you have to issue shares, right? What it means is that for lending for mortgages, right, it's about a quarter of the capital relative to lending to businesses.
Right.
What that means is that if I'm an executive in a bank and I'm saying, okay, I've got $1,000 to lend, right? Now, if I lend it to that business, it's going to cost me this much. But if I lend it to a mortgage holder, it's going to cost me this much. So I can do four times the amount.
Right.
Right. That's the problem.
The government.
And that basically was determined by the the Bank for International Settlements, Basel or Basel, depending on which part of the world you come from. And those rules are effectively determining now the basis of which banks actually behave, right? So it's sort of logical for them to actually drive into the mortgage sector because they can actually make their capital go a lot further. In Australia, if you look at the leverage ratios, right, about 5% of the capital in a bank is actually owned by the shareholders, right? All the rest of it, to make up the balance sheet, is actually borrowed from either depositors or from the markets.
Right.
Right? And what that means is that banks are highly leveraged institutions, right? And that's part of the problem, right? Because effectively they can leverage up massively for mortgages, which is why in Australia we've got 65% of our bank's books for mortgages, and you can add another 20% for construction sector. So, you know, the construction and housing sector is huge. And basically that's why the banks are at so much risk. And what that has done is to create now a sense of the banks only really want to lend for mortgages, nothing else, right? And they keep talking about, and it's interesting how all of the spiel recently with all of the support of the Reserve Bank, it's for businesses and for households, right? That's what they keep saying. But no, it's to support the banks. It's to support the banks and their ability to be able to pay returns to shareholders. That's what those support mechanisms have been. But here's the thing. Once you've actually got to the point where your business is fundamentally reliant on the housing sector, and you can't countenance falling house values, because if you did, your capital ratios will go all off and you have to put a lot more capital in. It would cost you an arm and a leg. And if you have defaults, it would cost you an arm and a leg. You've got myopic leverage. You've got myopic risks. All right.
Yes.
That's why now everyone's paranoid about property prices falling, right? Because if property prices fall, the banks probably fall over. And in fact, there was a Freedom of Information request to the Reserve Bank came out a couple of months ago, and it said this: the Reserve Bank was discussing whether they should stop the reporting of price indices for property because of COVID. They didn't want to actually publish the fact that property prices are going down because it might actually have a negative impact on the property market and on, quote, financial stability. Now, they didn't do that in the end, but the thought of even somebody discussing that, in other words, hiding what was happening to property prices, right? And as I said earlier on, those property indices are still not telling the full story in terms of what's going on at the moment. But people are now paranoid. So going back to what needs to change, you need to actually reduce the risks in the banking system by reducing the amount of lending for mortgages. And you do that fundamentally changing the rules, or think about whether you need those rules at all. You know, do you need that centralized? Why not allow the banks to make their own risk-based decisions, but take the risks and the rewards? Because the point I'd make at the moment is most banks are basically buttressed by the government and buttressed by the fact that, well, we'll get bailed out by somebody, right?
Right.
We've lost the whole idea of banks themselves being entrepreneurial and, frankly, doing the things that they do best and what they should have done, which was to be able to provide funding for businesses and to provide a home for deposits. We've lost the plot. So our banking system is not fit for purpose.
All right. Yeah, man, that makes so much sense. I know we're running short on time here, Martin. One more question I wanted to get your thoughts on is, in doing all your local statistical analysis and surveys, what's your read on the percentage of jobs that would or wouldn't come back if we were able to just flip a light switch and everything goes back to normal tomorrow? Bam, we get a vaccine or whatever. COVID's gone. It doesn't exist anymore. How many of those jobs would or would not come back?
Great question. We've got 3 million SMEs. About 1 million SMEs look to me as though they're at the point where they probably wouldn't come back. So about a third, I think, which translates to a hell of a lot of jobs. There are some people saying maybe it's 250,000. I think that's understating it. If the true unemployment rate becomes 9.25% relative to 5% where it was, 5.2 what it was previously, that would indicate a doubling of unemployment. And that would be an extra 800,000, 900,000 people potentially out of work. And of course, if you look at the trends, you go down the escalator when things get bad in terms of the unemployment rate, but you have to go up the stairs, and it can take 2 to 3 to 4 to 5 years to get back up again. So I'm seeing a lot of that in small business land, but I'm also now seeing it worryingly in Main Street as well. So some of the bigger corporations and companies, for example, some of the big consulting firms, some of the banks, they're laying people off too. So some of the other jobs that are going are from corporate to the corporate sector, what I call structural unemployment. And so as well as the small business owner struggling, we've now got structural unemployment at the top end. The only growth there at the moment is in the public sector. And I guess I have a question. Is it really sensible to just expand our public sector and basically, why don't we give everybody a job in the public sector and just have done with it? You know, let's stop being an entrepreneurial country and just being, you know, I suppose it's socialism, isn't it? I mean, is that really what we want? I mean, to my mind, if we do that, we've basically lost the plot. We have to find a way of reinvigorating and re-energizing and driving innovation back in to small businesses in the country. And there's almost no interest within the government to do that. There's a lot of talk, but very little action, massive amounts of red tape. In fact, I run my small business, right? I have the same rules and regulations and red tape as a multi-million dollar company in Australia, right? It's not fit for purpose. It's not fit for size. I spend more of my time doing administrivia than almost anything else. That can't be right. And in fact, the rules and regulations stop me hiring people, which I'd be quite keen to do, because once I do that, I've then got to pay minimum wages and I've then got to do a whole lot of additional administration stuff. It gets to the point where the incremental effort that I would need to take if I took my business to go any bigger is just not worth a candle. And I talk to thousands and thousands of businesses and they say precisely the same. We are not in an environment where the government is actually small business friendly. We're not in an environment where innovation is valued. We're in a society where, in fact, it's the large corporates who are ruling the roost, the government, the large corporates, and you know the Reserve Bank and everybody else, all on the same side, and everybody else is frankly just cannon fodder, and I find that disgraceful.
Yeah, that's so well put. It's the exact same thing that I've experienced in the United States. Well, Martin, you've been very generous with your time. I know you've got to get off to another interview, so for those of my viewers who want to find out more about what you do, go to your YouTube channel, social media, where can they go?
Okay, so my media footprint has my YouTube channel, which is called Walk the World, and that's where I have all of my shows, including the Soup to Nuts property one. If people want to get in an hour, everything to understand about why property is where it is, go there and have a look at that. I've also got a blog at digitalfinanceanalytics.com. I'm also on Twitter at DFA Analyst.
All right, Martin. I appreciate it, and I can't wait to do it again, buddy.
Good to talk to you. Take care. Keep safe.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com. Or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.